And he's whining already.
If we just did a tax on cigars and scotch, it would be very much narrowed in at the Republicans.
Good tax on Magoos, and then I don't have nowhere to go.
I'm starting to feel a whole lot more comfortable, Mr. Chair, with the formula the way it is.
Well, I think it was intended that we all end up running out of gas. That's somebody's agenda in this place is the status quo. That won't help us in equity, gentlemen and ladies.
We're at equity. It's just we don't like it. We're doing some stuff.
Well, let's. I'm sure that the record shows a series of gratuitous comments without context. Let's impose some context here. We have before us two bills. One is a tap-tap hearing on 509. Colleagues, remember that we the chairman has a little bit different view of 509 than some members do. I think 509 is a technical correction left over from a time when which we were trying to force the consolidation of small schools. Others view it as just a garden variety adjustment to the formula. We've moved the bill out to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but the chair wants to honor the commitment I made to the committee to array all of the issues that affect the school revenue formula together so we can see the effects before we essentially move forward on any of them. So we're going to just open a work session on Senate Bill 509 and bring it back to the committee and hold it until we have taken action on the other formula bill.
I was just curious about that from a procedural standpoint. So even though we voted it out of committee, we can, by our own action, bring it back into committee?
Yeah, apparently we can do that.
You need a motion.
The point is, to do that, I need a suspension of the rules.
I will move.
The committee, by acclamation, moves to suspend the rules. Are there any questions about the motion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections. Oh, do I have to be in work session to do this?
Yes.
I think I do.
You have to be in.
Let us open a work session on Senate Bill 509.
Chair,
Chair will entertain a motion.
Can I table it?
No. Not.
You have to have a first.
No. You need a motion to suspend the rules?
So moved.
The motion is to suspend the rules. Any questions about the motion? Any objections to the motion?
Hearing
and seeing none?
Definitely.
Rules are suspended. Chair needs a motion to bring this bill back to the committee.
You just did that.
But we weren't in work session.
Chairman,
we suspended it. So much.
I'm afraid to call Senator Minnis. Senator Minnis?
Well, I guess the question I'd like to ask is, do you want to hold it back and keep it in our possession?
Yes. Only so that we can array this side by each with the other bills and then move whatever we move out as a package.
All right. Now, it's a kind of procedural question, so that in order for the bill to move to the floor again, we would need another motion to move it forward to due pass and another work session on the bill.
Yes, we would do.
So
the chair is willing to take the risk of the committee that that's what we will ultimately do.
Okay. And so if we tabled it, then you'd have to have a motion to remove it from the table
before
you have a motion to send it to the Senate floor.
Right. However, I think they essentially accomplish the same goal. The committee never votes the bill out.
As opposed to postponing indefinitely, which prevents us from ever dealing with it.
Postponing indefinitely is a shot dog, I think, Senator Minnis. Do you refer to that in the business?
Well, I'll cooperate.
Then I have a motion from Senator Minnis that we reconsider Senate Bill 509 in this committee. And this motion is undebatable, apparently, but that looks like that's the suspension. Okay, so Senator Minnis moves to reconsider the vote whereby the committee moved Senate Bill 509 to the floor of Senate with a recommendation of passage. Any objections? Any discussion? Hearing no objections, hearing no discussion, so ordered. The work session on Senate Bill 509 is closed. Colleagues, we have 509 back.
Yay.
All right, colleagues, we have the other bill on the table, that is, or at least on the agenda. That's Senate Bill 61. And we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 61. Question I have for the staff is, we've heard 61 before, that's the one that extends the ADMW to a five-year period and puts a glide path rather than a cliff in front of school districts. Colleagues, this bill also will affect the ADMW, and it does so by extending the number of actual head counts of students beyond the physical number of students present in the system at any given time. And there's been some discussion about how we approach that issue. The question before us is, do we wish to move this bill out to help those schools that have precipitously lost ADMW? I suppose stands in counterpoint to those that have precipitously gained ADMW. Paul, do you have any additional information to add to the committee's understanding of Senate Bill 61?
Mr. Chair, just to point out for the committee that you have 61 arrayed against the other bills and shows how that would affect the distribution. Keep in mind that Measure 61 has some key parameters in it. The most obvious one is number of years. And the way the bill is currently written, it's 5 years. So Steve had worked up a printout for you showing 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. So that, I think, is a key decision on this bill, how many years you want to go in terms of extending back into the past. The other issue that I think is important is whether you want to treat this as a peak year for whatever period you're looking at. Say we go back 3 years to allow districts to count their peak enrollment during that period, or to use some kind of a moving average, which would be a more stable estimate of what their ADM would be. So you could have a moving average over a 3 or 4 year or 2 year period. So those, I think, are the key technical decisions to be made. There's also an issue of how to treat mergers in both the past and in the future under this type of system.
So the decisions are, would it be 2, 3, 4, or 5 years that we actually extend the ADMW headcount?
Mm-hmm.
The other is whether we take the current year's peak year or we use some kind of a rolling average.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that you will capture it?
Those are the technical issues. The bigger issue, Mr. Chair, that you raised in memo to the committee is do you want to use this vehicle to deal with some of the concerns of the higher growth districts and build that into the same bill or look at that using another vehicle? That opens a much broader issue.
Well, I'd like to poll the committee on an issue here, and I'll ask each of the members in turn. Do we, according to your best judgment, do we do something for schools that have precipitously lost ADMW through a mill closure, through a loss of economic base, through some kind of a situation that causes population dislocation? Is that something that this committee believes is a reasonable thing to do? And if that's true, then if the committee concurs that that is a reasonable approach, then I think we also need to look at those districts that have had real stress from rapid increases. Well, Senator Corcoran, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just have a process point, and you and I have talked about how we could look at the 29 million federal forest money, taking it outside the formula, and you know the calculation is that it would be a $5 loss sort of across the board ADMW to take it out, and then placing it back in, there would be different winners and losers, but that is not calculated in here, and I would submit that that's another piece of the puzzle. I mean, we still, the reason it's not in here is because we haven't decided on, you know, what mechanism to use and defined who those eligible school districts would be. We talked about going through the counties to do it and to do it on a flat grant amount so we don't have the anomalies that you get in Eastern Oregon with the $1,200 a student and stuff. You just make it a flat grant. And the other variation of the theme was that we might look at giving a small dollar amount more to the really small school districts and have some breakoff points of 500, 1,000, 1,500, something like that. But none of that is in. I mean, I can look at this and basically it's unappealing. I mean, two school districts get tremendous gain, you know, in Lane County, but, you know, some just suffer unreasonable losses. You know, Eugene, after the whole thing, you look at poor Jay, after all those permutations, and they end up at absolutely no change. If all four bills were enacted, Eugene's net would be zero. But Bethel loses big time, and there's some other big-time losers, and some huge gains for Marcola and Crowfoot-Lorain. So the only thing I'm wondering is, you know, where we proceed in terms of looking at that federal dollars, and whether, you know, I should go to Mr. Meyer when he gets back and ask him to. I think we'd almost have to hand-identify those school districts that we thought were eligible and then move the money through the counties. That seemed to be the only way to do it.
Well, there are several theories in operation, and there's some legal opinions being sought that may have a pretty significant effect on how those dollars are regarded. But maybe if I could get to the question that I'm hearing you ask, should that also be arrayed side by side with these other things? Is that really the issue that you bring to the table?
Yes.
We can add that to the spreadsheet. You get a bigger spreadsheet. But the other issue that I think you've raised reasonably, but let's close on this. Let us add this issue to the spreadsheet, and then that will be arrayed with the other thing. The other observation that you made is one that we were admonished early on to be aware of, and that is that over the course of many corrections, there will be some that cancel, you know, in terms of any equation.
Yeah.
The issues that won't go away, that keep us returning to this issue, to the set of questions, is there a real issue in terms of equity, either with the current ADMW formula or with the ESP funding? And notwithstanding at least one opinion, other opinions to the contrary indicate, yes, there's an actionable issue with equity if we ignore the ESP funding formula. And yes, there is some distribution questions, even within the current formula, about equity. And I think we get to that by looking at services. But let's come back to the procedural issues here. I don't think we're going to get off the dime if we don't agree to some principles as a committee. And so I'm going to ask a set of questions that I think gets us to a set of principles. And nothing's dispository by, you know, acknowledging that you feel one way or another way on the question, but it does help us narrow down what the decision space is. My opinion is that we do, in fact, need to do something to adjust the ADMW for schools that have so precipitously lost population that they now, on the ADMW formula, fall below the critical mass to operate the school. If we don't do that, I think we run the risk of having some real serious problems in the local communities with school closures. So that's, you know, at least for myself, I would answer the question, do we do anything to adjust the ADMW to schools that have lost student population? The answer for me is yes, we should do something within the formula. At the other end of that spectrum is another question. What do we do for schools that have so precipitously gained that we need to acknowledge that they're under similar stresses, but from increasing population?
That's not in the formula, right, Mr. Chair?
Not in the formula before.
I mean, nothing that we've looked at.
Right.
Okay.
But we are looking at the concept of taking the $17 million that we've allocated for grant funding for infrastructure and asking to increase the facilities grant program to $25 billion. And we even have the staff at Legislative Fiscal looking at leasing for the first time as an option under facilities grants, because some school districts might be able to follow a population bubble through their school system without building a new school. You know, if you look at the Eugene situation, it's not because they're losing population necessarily. The population's aging and changing. And there are neighborhood schools that are now no longer supportable within that neighborhood. They're talking about closing some of those schools. It's not because they don't have, you know, sufficient populations, but the demographics and the locations of neighborhoods has changed within those districts. Senator Beyer has a question.
Paul, can you refresh my memory? The current formula looks back 2 years. It's the highest of, so there's sort of a...
the current formula, that's where the term extended comes from. You look at your enrollment the current year and compare it with the previous year and use the highest of the two.
Year or biennial?
Year. All school budgeting is done on an annual basis.
So in terms of the actual dollar amounts, because we're increasing the size of the pie, is it true that no one is likely to have gotten less money than they had in the previous fiscal year?
Well, the actual amount of money they get would be determined by the total amount of the pot. But if, as long as the pot is growing, they can't have a.
The reality is we've got an increase from 4.8 something to 5.2 in the spreadsheet. So no one is getting less money.
Well, they can get less money in terms of enrollment because if you're in the current period, you're looking at the current period versus last year. If last year was higher. Then the next year you ratchet that forward 1 year, and then you go back to what is now the current year. So, yeah, you will have declining enrollment. It just gives you a 1 year lag as to when that counts in terms of the distribution.
So, if we're looking forward at a biennium, if you were looking at the highest, or not less than the highest of the last three, then you would in essence have a full promise where your last year is funded.
Well. Again, Senator, I would hesitate to use the word hold harmless because the previous year, if you go back 3 years and you're declining each year, then you're always going back. You're being ratcheted down, but you're just being ratcheted down based on where you were 3 years ago. So, when we talked about how to do this, using a peak year versus an average, a moving average would make that more of a slope. Down because if you added a year here, the average for years would drop.
So get to the chair's point, and there's two different questions there. One is, do you sort of buffer the slowdown? And the other one is really the question is there a minimum level of funding that's necessary to operate a school district?
Senator Mann?
I guess I'm a little perplexed here in that. In some sense, we're maybe extending the obvious, if you have a declining enrollment, you have a declining population, you have a declining industrial base, to what extent is it the state's role to maintain a school district in a region that's just simply economically dying?
Well, Senator Minister, I appreciate the question. I guess I would submit to you that all the areas in Oregon are economically changing. The question about whether or not they're economically dying depends on whether the infrastructure that keeps people in the community disappears. The forest products industry probably could be likened to other cyclical like steel in the mid-Atlantic states or in the Midwest states through the Rust Belt and the Corn Belt or cotton 100 years ago in the South. The point is that eventually other economic opportunities displace those that have either turned down or disappeared, but like those sectors, also public policy is what's driven the forest products downturn in some of our communities, the cattle downturn in other communities.
Do we have an example of number one? I mean, identification of what the problem is that we're attempting to fix here.
Yes, very clearly.
I'm looking through my stuff, and I don't see a clear definition of what the problem is, other than we know we have some districts that are declining in enrollment. But to me, I don't know what that's relevant to. I mean, where are the examples of...
Well, if you could try to connect the dots, a precipitous decline in economic conditions leading to out-migrations in students.
But do we have examples of districts within the state where this is actually happening so that we can kind of get a sense for how... whether we're triaging a problem or literally, it's an emergency as opposed to, this is just something that's naturally happening. And the reason I ask that is because to the extent that we tweak this to try to accommodate declining enrollment, then you're taking money away from my school districts, that they're going to argue just as vehemently we shouldn't do. So I need to have the...
Yes, we are. And in fact, of course, we've all heard the argument about, well, are we taking money away or are we flattening the growth?
Right. So problem, example, justification.
Okay, problem, Hepner. No closure. Pilot or Pioneer Resources. issue. 100 or so jobs are gone, and those 100 plus families took about 150 kids out of the local school district. Result, over $1 million lost in the high school. So now what do you do? Does the district, in fact, absorb that by cutting programs and teachers and therefore lower their opportunity to recruit some other industrial base into the community because the school is perceived as being in decline? And so, you know, it's not just a social issue or a social question. It's also very much an economic development issue. I mean,
it almost seems what you're describing, there's a need to set money aside, perhaps, and in the judgment of, you know, certified smart people like the superintendent of public instruction, you know, in consultation with the economic development department and others, you know, might allocate monies because they have an indication that certain markets are going to open up, and it's arguable that you should sustain the school district. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to changing the entire formula.
Senator, you're absolutely right, and I guess staying with the example of Hefner, the Oregon Economic Development Department, and this legislature in the last session created 12 new enterprise zones, 6 east of the Cascades. One of them is in Hefner. They specifically modified the Port District boundaries to allow a Port District extension from Arlington all the way to Hefner to take in the closed mill site to redevelop it. So we have wastewater water infrastructure grants in Oregon Economic Development Department bonds financing change, systemic change within the Hefner community. So all those things are happening in context of reaction to this cyclical downturn in the forest products industry and the loss of the mill. Question is, do we let the school fail while we're trying to do all this other infrastructure stuff? And the issue is, you know, which comes first, a good hospital and a good school system, and then you can recruit business, or do you recruit the business and then try to rebuild a closed hospital and a deteriorated school system? Senator Corcoran.
Well, the other example that I'd like to give Senator Menace is, and I presume you don't see so much of this in the area that you represent, but the other fundamental question, you have sort of the economic, you know, the big bang economic hit that Hefner describes, but the other situation you have is Marcola, right outside of Springfield, which has had a declining enrollment for a long period of time, and it's getting to a point where the critical mass is not there, and so they face consolidation with the Springfield School District. The question you have at that point is not a question of economic development for a city. The question you have is the maintenance of a small community. So Marcola is an unincorporated community. It has a fire district, basically, and it has a school district, you know, and the sort of policy question that ends up being asked is, and you kind of hit on it earlier, you know, is what's the sort of base criteria that you could, the base level that you could keep some of these school districts afloat? You know, it's died a long, slow death, and you asked a very good question that's at the base of it, and that is, you know, is it the state's role to artificially, one could say, or at the expense of other school districts, maintain these school districts that are just on the precipice? And that's a difficult question. I mean, I think that I go back and forth on this, looking at these variations. It's a really hard question to answer.
Well, in a, I hope a pejorative sense, the question's been asked, you know, is the state in the business of creating new ghost towns? You know, we heard that arguably, at least in Eastern Oregon, that public policy at the federal level was designed to displace population out of communities. And so the woods were shut down, and the grazing is shut down, and the mining is shut down, and the people are forced to seek jobs in the cities. I don't know whether that's a public policy that's ever been articulated by an administration, but it's been articulated by some critics of the environmental community. So the bottom line is, here we are. We've got schools, we've got communities that are hoping that there will be a reversal in federal forest mining and grazing policy in rural Oregon. And the question is, will their school be open if there is a change in policy? Senator Byers.
It's a difficult question dealing with this. I mean, there's some of the demographics that we're going to have to deal with is that if you look at the total state student population and where it's projected to go, it's flattening. In fact, it's probably going to decrease a little bit, not a lot, but it's down, which is different than we've seen the last few years. But within that, not any more students in the system. The changes that we're seeing is that most of the smaller communities, most of the inner city schools, whether the inner city is a Corvallis or a Salem or a Portland, are going to have decreasing populations of students. And the periphery, the suburban schools are going to have increasing populations. So you're left in terms of an equity model. You certainly have the survival of a small town issue there, and you know, how much does it cost to run a school, a small school district? But you have the quality of the educational experience. You have in most of the small schools class sizes of, you know, under 20 in many cases, in most cases, very small classes. While the cost of providing those are that in the inner city schools, you've got class sizes of 20 to 35 students. It's just a matter of where you shift the dollars to. I guess the answer really is one, is if we want to maintain all of that, if we want to take care of the growth, maintain the quality of the existing schools, and protect the small schools, you need a bigger bucket.
Yep.
Well, let me suggest to you...
It's more expensive to do all that.
Let me suggest to you, colleagues, that it's only a difficult question if you don't live in one of those small communities. The issue is, in perspective, from looking at a smaller community to a large community, is large communities have choices and options. Small communities have time and distance against them in terms of choices and options. So if your school is, you know, if your community is remote or isolated or distance away from another community, the choice is about, well, we can consolidate schools, or we can join together, and we can aggregate demand, or we can move population around. Those choices really don't exist. So the question is, are we going to have equal education for all kids in the state of Oregon on a service basis? Or are we going to essentially say the small schools are cast adrift and the large schools, and anything that gets done in terms of equity comes at the expense of the large schools? You know, that's an argument that can be run. You can run that argument, and you can do it passionately, and you can support the argument with the statistics. But the issue is, you know, are schools going to be in rural and small and urban communities that are losing population? And the focal point is Senate Bill 61. Are we going to do something for schools that precipitously lose population to help them buffer that issue?
No, I think that I don't think there's a single one of us on this committee who doesn't want to help those schools. I think we all want to help schools, those smaller school districts. I think where we're differing is how we go about doing it, and so the solution. But I don't think any of us disagree that, yeah, if we have these isolated school districts and they, you know, their programs are just you know, really in need of extra help, yeah, we want to see all students succeed in Oregon. We don't want to see anybody left behind. We want to support all students to be successful. So I think, you know, yeah, let's step up and help them, and let's try to figure out a way that we can do that by looking at other questions that I think need to be asked as we're looking for solutions. And I think one of the questions we need to ask ourselves is, for the rest of the school districts, do we think that the rest of those school districts have enough money or have too much money? You know, do they have small enough class sizes? Do we not need to worry about how big their class sizes are? Do we not need to worry about the students in those other districts having obstacles to learning or achievement gaps in those other school districts or enough counselors in those other school districts? And if we can answer, you know, that we think that all the rest of those school districts are just have, you know, all the money they need to provide every single student the best possible program, you know, then...
Well, Senator...
and I think that that's a question that we really do need to look at.
Well, the answer to that question is obvious, and the answer is no. But we are not in an unlimited system without some parameters around it. The parameters that we have are, what are the resources currently available? Not what are the resources we wish were currently available, but what are they? And whether or not, in relative terms, there is something that we can do within that framework that benefits the whole system, because it maintains integrity of the whole system. But, you know, I understand your question. In a perfect world, we wouldn't be having this discussion. We don't live in a perfect world. And in a situation where we don't have any limitations on the availability of funding for education, which might be where we'd all like to be, then we wouldn't have this question. We're not in either of those circumstances. What we have is a finite amount of resources, which is everything we can get into the school funding formula. But that tends not to make funds available for every circumstance everywhere. But unless we start to factor these things and answer some questions about principle, and here's the point of me asking this question. If we think we should do something about schools that are precipitously losing population, then we move that into the column of, yes, we need to do something about this. We haven't defined what the something is. If we go back and look at the other set of questions that are before this committee, should we do something for schools that have grown in areas so fast that they can't cope with growth, then we move that into, yes, we should do something about that. If we listen to the question that was brought by the school superintendent or by the superintendent of public education, should we try to do something with the formula that acknowledges that most of the folks in the ADA situation or IEP situation are in a paper chase, and we could at least acknowledge that half the paper chase could go away with a formula adjustment from 11% to 13%, we should then that falls into the column of, okay, we should do something about that. Mm-hmm. If we look at the ESD report and agree that we don't want to take anything away from the larger districts in order to fund the smaller districts, but that there's $16 million in growth projected within that formula, and the committee's brought to us a way to distribute the extra dollars that'll grow into that formula over the biennium to those kids that have a disability issues, and they did that. They brought us a formulaic approach that would help bring equity to that question. And we look at doing something for the school districts or the ESDs that are the likeliest to have a case at equity for equalization. We do something in that area, again, staying within that formula for growth that's in the governor's budget and we assume will be in the co-chair's budget. Then we've moved toward equity. We haven't destroyed budgets. We've stayed within the capabilities of the legislature. That, to me, seems like the only thing that we can do in light of the fact that we're not going to fully fund the quality education model in this legislative session. Far from it. You know, the revenue predictions are down, not up. So it's my desire to get through the issues with this committee so that we can decide what this committee is going to do with school funding. You know, are we going to make adjustments to this funding formula? My intention is that we do that, I think because we are obligated to do it, on the equity question. Senator Byer.
Let's be careful how we use the terms. We are at relative equity now on funding per student through our adjusted formula. We may not be at a point where that amount of money allows each school district to provide the same level of services. In fact, we know we're not there. And there's great variations in the services that are provided based on the fact that those decisions are made by local school boards. So it's not a question of monetary equity. It may be a question of economic sufficiency.
Or service equity. But let me add one principle to what you just said. You said we are at relative equity. I would add, with certain exceptions. And those certain exceptions have expressed themselves in four or five bills that this committee's got before us. If we're not willing to take the exceptions, then we ought to just say that. Put an end to the discussions about school funding formulas and report to the leadership in the building that the status quo is the best approach because the committee can't agree on this what the certain exceptions are. And if that's the sum total of the output of this legislative session, we probably should just get on with it because we've got lots of other bills we can be considering. Keep endlessly revisiting these questions isn't getting the question solved. I believe there's some equity adjustments that need to be made. I think there's some communities in extremity that are looking to this legislature for assistance. And if we're going to help them, we should do. And if we're not going to help them, we should tell them that now. Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, you are beating this horse to death. The fact of the matter is you can't simultaneously say that the pie cannot get bigger because somebody else in the building decided the pie can't get bigger,
and that we're not looking at OIA funding, we're not looking at SCF funding, we're not looking at other program areas besides education that are sorely needed, or else anything we do on this committee is meaningless. We're just stockpiling these kids with problems, and these communities get screwed. Back to the question that we were talking about earlier, I would like to ask Ozzy and John, for instance, to come up and, from a policy standpoint, tell us what kind of discussions they have in their two groups about these issues, because they have to have these discussions. Yeah, I know you don't want to quit.
They're both running for
them. Yeah, well, that's why I named them early. But I want to hear, you know, I'd like to hear what a group of administrators says about, you know, do we fish or cut bait? Do we let go of these small school districts, or do we keep them at the expense of the larger school districts? You know, and I'd like to hear what the school boards have to say about that, because we're just beating this thing to death up here. We're trying to have this discussion about zero sum and not looking at these real, you know, needs like Heppner. So, I mean, you know, I'd rather hear, if you want us to make a public policy decision, then I want to hear what these other two groups have to say about what their deliberations come up with in these policy areas, and then we can make a decision.
Gentlemen, you've been called out.
Oh, we never asked.
So, Mr. Chair, can I start with Ozzy? So, Ozzy, your groups have to have these discussions. You've got small schools, large schools, fast growth schools, and schools that are dying on the vine. What kind of discussions do you guys have about whether you take care of one at the expense of another?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, specifically Senator Corcoran, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The start of our discussions are exactly like the last 45 minutes or so that you're... Because all of the answers involve moving money from somewhere to somewhere, or away and to. And I've explained to you before that we have a group of 42 superintendents. That's about 42 out of 178 or whatever there are. So it's a very good sample. And we have rich and poor, small and large, suburban, urban, et cetera. We had this debate throughout this last 2 years, actually, since you went home last time. And I think they all agree that we are relatively at equity. But. And then all the buts are how the equity works in their particular arena. And the bills that you've had introduced didn't, I don't think most of those came from legislators. I think they came from school people talking to legislators. I think I've testified before that this discussion is not unlike what I go through regularly. They concluded that just rearranging the money was not worthwhile. That was a position. Leave the formula alone. We're the 5.2, we have a shot at getting that. And by the way, when you roll that out into what schools actually get, I'm getting increasing numbers of folks saying, now, if you actually look at the dollars I had last time, what we're going to have next time under these rules, it's running 2.5% to 3% increase, and I'm supposed to invest. You know all that. So then the issue arises, which of these problems are the worst problems? Declining enrollment is a very serious problem to a district that's losing kids, but it's a problem that won't go away. I mean, the one earlier, that they're going to continue to decline. Somebody's got to grab that by the horn someday. Eugene's closing three schools or two, whatever. North Bend's closing two. If they weren't, like if you pass the declining enrollment bill, Because Baserman called me and said, I want to know if it's going to pass. I'm not arguing for it against it. But if it passes, I pick up $1.5 million, and I don't have to go through the agony this spring of closing two schools. And so you know how he feels about declining enrollment.
So what does Heppner say?
Well,
Heppner is a...
I just wanted to get that in.
Okay. Heppner is a little bit different situation. It's a county school district with three high schools. And they have there's a subcommittee now of small rural high school people that are working on, and I'm working with them, because our committee, after it said, let's leave it alone, then they also said, the very small schools are having a tough, really tough time, and if they can't survive, it isn't survival. The larger you get, it isn't survival, it's quality of things and so forth. You'll still survive. Are there situations where you can't survive in terms of a base, adequate program? Then you're doing a disservice to kids to keep the schools open.
And there are those who would like to tell Heppner, you could move Ione to Heppner or whatever. Everybody outside has an answer for that, but that's an answer that they've got to decide on locally. Heppner is not as in bad shape. Ione is the one that's a very difficult shape in that school district. And as I said, I'm working on an idea there. I also, and I just talked to Chastain, by the end of the day, I'm going to have a run. You've had a run that says, and at the top of it says, don't try to add these up. They don't add up. I'm trying to run these ideas in the same run. And one of the problems with your concern about declining enrollment and the large growth districts, you do both those together, you're going to take us more money away from Beaverton for declining enrollment than you give them for growth. And so in the end, is that really worthwhile? And there is not a very nice answer when you're trying to stay in the box that is there for us. None of you looked up when Mr. Byers said the box is not big enough. I jumped up and did this, but none of you noticed. The pod isn't big enough to address every school district's problems. And whether you should or shouldn't, we're meeting again on Friday, and I'm going to have a proposal for them on the small school issue. But I'm emailing my email this morning from the district in the middle, McMinnville. McMinnville would not benefit from the decline enrollment change, would not benefit from high growth, would not benefit from the IEP thing. And every single change you make costs McMinnville money. And there's a group of districts that kind of the average districts, and I tell them, my response to them is, you're kind of like the average kid in our schools. We take and take and take from the average kid who doesn't cause any trouble, does his homework, gets hauled to school accurately, and so forth, because we have so many demands by the children at risk and the IEP-type kids, and we press to do something for the TAG kids. Kind of if you're in the middle, and that's where a lot of our, about probably half of your school districts fit in that middle. That doesn't solve the problem of the little ones that's struggling to survive, nor does it solve the problem of the suburbans that are growing so fast. Their growth, probably the operating money keep, you know, that grows so they get that. Their biggest issue is where do you get enough capital money to keep up with the needs? You just ask, where are my group? Now, I try to describe that. Now, what do I think you should do? I hope on Friday with a group of superintendents to come back and say, we either think you got to leave that blasted thing alone and you'll have to decide whether we're nuts and you can't do that, or we're going to come back and say, we think you ought to make this tweak or that tweak. And I, you know, Mr. Feroli has asked me in his office a couple of times and talked to me pretty straightforwardly about either help find an answer or get out of the way, kind of. And when you had 509 up, I think you had three superintendents in here testifying in favor of it, one of them who sits on my committee. The group of small district superintendents that I'm working on with that, six of them sit on our committee, and they're in another committee working on changing. So it is not just, your discussion is, the pot isn't big enough to address everybody's perceived needs. And I know Senator Minnis thinks we got more money than we need, and that's his view, and that's fine. But if this is all money you're going to have, you're not going to distribute it in a way that solves the growth problem, their description of their problems, and the rural schools, their description of their problems.
Okay, hold.
You want me to shut up?
Hold your powder for just a minute. I think the discussion at least ratifies what the committee's after and what we're engaged in. And I commend the committee for the insightful nature of their questions. You know, we're finally having maybe some genuinely insightful discussions. We're talking about the stuff that's real. I appreciate the fact that Mr. Rose ratifies what we're saying here, because it would distress me to feel that there were solutions that we're not getting to. So at least we're having the same agony, if that's the way to describe that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rose, I don't personally think the pot's going to get any bigger this session. And so I guess I'm just trying to get the committee to acknowledge that although I agree that there isn't enough money in education to do all the things that everybody wants to do, the reality of the situation is we are stuck with what we have. And in that instance, there are some places where the but is bigger than the formula. Yes, there's equity, but. And if that's the case, then this committee, I believe, has an obligation to forthrightly articulate what is the exception and do something about it. Not to do that leaves those kids in those schools, whether they're overcrowded or underpopulated, without access to equal education in Oregon, and I don't think that's right. So, you know, I've invited Mr. Rose to my office at least a couple of times, and most of the time it doesn't involve rubber hoses and beatings. But Mr. Rose, I will say, has his abilities to give as good as he gets in this building, and no one should mistake that possibility. But in fact, there is agreement that some adjustments need to be made in the formula, and that Mr. Rose will help make those adjustments. Or have I misstated that, Mr. Rose?
No, Ms. Chairman, if I offend you, I apologize.
No,
I never offended. There's a science issue and a pragmatic issue and a political issue. You got to get those three things together. There is some science behind deciding that small schools or growing schools don't have enough money. And you got to try to use the science as best you can so you make a rational decision. Then you got to get pragmatic in that it is the middle of March and you are going to go home and 5.2 is all the money it's going to be, and if we're not careful, it won't be that much. And then there's a political issue of once you make that pragmatic quasi-scientific decision, can you get 16 and 31 votes to do it? And I'm sorry, that's the way I'm functioning, and I hope to have more advice for you after Friday, but I can't deliver without people behind me saying that's how we
have to do it. I believe that's absolutely the best presentation that we've heard, at least I've heard in this building, about what this committee is up against.
Yeah.
Now, let me add to it. To get to the way we help kids, we all have to let go of the postures that we brought into this building and start looking at what's real and whether or not we're going to help people who need help. And we're not going to get there if all we're going to do is bang the drum. And there's an awful lot of that going on, but it's March. And pretty soon we run out of time here. If all we're going to do is play down the clock, you know, we may as well get to the game over now so we can move on to the important business of tax restructuring. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just do a perception check with both of you. You know, we're all somewhat captive to the media we watch and the sphere that we surround ourselves in. I get a different picture when I'm in the Capitol building than I do when I'm at home, which I'm fortunate enough to be able to do every night. Last session when we left, I went out of here and made the statement to people that we did better in education funding overall than I thought we would when we came into the building, and I thought we had maybe not solved all the problems, but pretty much solved most of the problems. I made the mistake of making that statement in an audience of superintendents and school board members, and proceeded to get my head taken off as they explained to me the cuts that they were going through at that time and had all those years. The environment that I'm seeing now, and one of the reasons that I'm usually very open to the discussions that the chair is putting forward, but I will tell you, as I go home every night now, the reports that I get 2 to 3 times a week in the paper, because the districts I represent are in budget discussions, are in the last 3 months discussions about how many and which schools to close and what programs are going to be lost. And the ones that I'm looking at, I don't think are frivolous programs. They're very serious things that are on top of a lot of others. My question, that's a long intro, my question is, how much is that discussion, is that a common discussion throughout the state that you're hearing from school superintendents and school board members? I mean, is that the common experience? Is that where we're at with education in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Rosie Byer, last week on Monday night, I was at a dinner meeting of superintendents and board members in Pendleton. I went over and went back one day, so I do know about windshields. Dinner meeting in Wilsonville on Tuesday night, and a dinner meeting in Eugene on Thursday night, or Wednesday night, and I did not go with a group to Medford on Thursday night, selling the 5.2 and how the model worked, et cetera, and selling the concept we have to invest in grades 3, grades 5 benchmarks in the improvement fund, and lots of understanding of why we need to invest in the benchmarks, et cetera. But across the board, it's me. We are going, the budgets are going up 2.5-3%, and you're going to cut programs to do everything you want to do, and that's by and large across the state.
So the point is, Senator Byer, what you're hearing
exactly
from your community is exactly what everyone's hearing from their community.
Yes.
Precisely.
Yeah. So everybody is, it'd be correct to say that, at least in your opinion, those districts that are not having to try and figure out how to deal with expansions of students and needing new schools, which are predominantly in the valley, the rest of them are trying to figure out how to maintain their core programs.
Well, and I think, I've heard some, even the Beavertons and Hillsboro and so forth, in terms of the programs they currently have, and et cetera, that they are looking at reduction of programs over the next 2 years at the rate of growth that's available in the 5.2 billion. And I'm not offering this argument for more. I understand we're not going to get more, okay? But you said, what do you hear across the state? And I think it's across the state, period. And it's just different intensity and different versions of the same problem. In the small school, it might be survival. In the large school, it's how many more kids can we jam into certain things so we can keep this other thing.
I hazard to guess that in the medium-sized school, it's how do we hold on to the programs that we have, facing the possibility and prospect of formula
change.
Adjustments.
Yes, that's
and if we do make formula adjustments, then truly all the schools will be in the same circumstance.
Mr. Chairman,
we had Senator Starr. Senator Minnis, you've had your hand up and down a couple times, but Senator Starr has not even raised his hand yet this morning.
I'll defer to Senator.
Defer to Senator Starr. You have the floor, Senator.
Thank you. I think there's another whole side to this issue that we've made whatever investment that we've made in education. But I believe that fundamentally we have invested in programs that are not as productive as we know how to make them. And I don't know what the exact figures are, but somewhere around 40% of the IEP students are on IEPs because they don't read. The for 50 years or so we've been on a whole language program for teaching reading. And I believe that the clear evidence is that those students who come with the least asset, English as a second language, or poor families, or broken homes, or whatever, require the intensive phonics as a basis for their beginning learning, and we're not giving it to them. And it seems to me that we should face up to that and solve that problem. I don't know how to get there. I've been struggling with that issue for years. But Arizona and California have now passed, by initiative, the curtailment of bilingual education. How much is that costing us in this state? And how much greater benefits do we get by starting children with an English immersion program and the intensive funding? Are there not tremendous savings to be had if we begin to teach all children to read in kindergarten, first grade? And why can't we do those things that will get us there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that gives me great confidence that since you're the chair of the Education Committee, we'll see something emerge from your committee that helps us.
We're going to try. But,
Mr. Chair, I think he was asking me questions. Is that correct?
That's right.
Mr. Chair.
Actually, I believe the issue before us is what are we going to do about school funding?
I know, but I was going to try to talk, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I don't have answers for a series of those questions. The first part you laid out, the reference to the 40% of the kids on IEPs, I don't know if that's exactly right or not, but it does relate to the funding formula in terms of IEP. I think the IEP issue, and I share this with the chair, I think our best choice of direction or action on the IEP question is to fund the State Department to take on the entire preschool through the stuff we do for the kids before school on the IEP related kind of things, all the way through the very costly, expensive kids, and spend this next 2 years sorting that out I don't believe that the concept of the average necessarily is working anymore, but I don't have any evidence to prove it is or isn't. It works sometimes, it doesn't. So that raises questions about the 2.0. It's clearly when they move a large number of high-cost kids into a community, suddenly it doesn't work what we have to help those communities, those schools. And when I came into this thinking, well, the state will pick up everything over 4X, and then I saw the number, that probably isn't the right way to address this, but we need a fresher look at the, and the feds are supposedly going to give us more money for the special ed. I don't know if it's going to materialize. We need a fresh look at that, and would encourage us to press that as part of this discussion.
The from anecdotal information, both in this committee and on Senator Starr's Education Committee, I'm getting a picture of IEP programs and referrals that shows me that the independent education program is one of the only tools teachers have. And so they make referrals that may not be appropriate referrals. They make referrals because that's the only thing they can do. But there is a rapidly growing population under independent education programs. The question is, do they work? I don't know. Senator Minnis, you've been very patient. Let me go to you for questions of Mr. Rosen. Then we have only 35 minutes for Mr. John to ask. No. Then actually, I think that it was fair for Mr. Corcoran's question and consideration to bring the other gentleman forward in testimony. Senator Minnis, did you have a question?
Well, kind of a statement, maybe a question. I don't know. I think this committee has to take seriously the history of the, you know, the creation, formation of the ADMW. There's a lot of history in terms of how that, you know, comes about, and then the prior legislative sessions, discussions, and histories in terms of the equity question for general education. So I guess when I ask my earlier question, what I'm really trying to say is, give me a compelling need or justification or reason for moving outside of the ADMW in this distribution formula to deal with some of these problems. So I mean, in one sense, we can say, yeah, everybody's got problems, and we probably shouldn't change because we have the history and so on and so forth. However, I would suggest that if there are compelling needs, i.e. you've got a Hefner or somebody else who's in very serious declining enrollment environment, then we probably ought to try to do something for that purpose. Now, there's a small schools initiative. But when I look at the runs, and I'm looking at my school districts losing $1 million each, and Portland gaining $99,000, knowing that Portland, I know I get in trouble when I say this kind of stuff, and Portland had a population student growth of, or student population of about 80,000 some 10, 15 years ago. They're now at about 47,000. They still have infrastructure for 80,000 students. They've had some financial investments and issues and problems and things that I think were misguided financial decisions prior to Measure 5 that's exacerbated some of their existing problems. But at the same time, this whole Senate Bill 61 tends to move money all over the map as opposed to try to address those significant problems where justification would arise. And that's kind of the difficulty that I'm trying to weigh here. Give me a compelling need, a compelling justification for doing what we're doing, and I'm on board. And I personally think we need a small schools initiative, which is a set aside of dollars that, based on a certain set of identification of certain problems, the money's then allocated kind of separate from the ADMW that's justified based on whatever that, you know, those compelling needs are. But then that's not what we're doing. We're kind of doing this in a piecemeal way, and I'm not really sure whether your suggestion, Mr. Chair, earlier was to try to do this within the ADMW or to do it separate from, and then look at how all the money moves. To me, that's pretty confusing. I'd rather try to deal with the ADMW with its historical base, know that the general population of students out there are going to get X number of dollars per student, and then we've identified specific problems like the high-cost students in the ESD question that came up earlier, so that we know that the money might ultimately move with the students, as opposed to having various districts. So identify the problem of high-cost students and identify another problem of small schools initiative, and kind of try to deal with those things separately in their individual components, as opposed to try to picture it all together.
Well, let me frame that in the terms of a question for both the gentlemen, and then I'd like to hear from John. But Mr. Rose, was there consideration of funding all the districts and looking at the 3.5% growth to address the high growth, low you know, high loss, high growth, and then ADMW and IEP students in the middle. Did anybody discuss maintaining the status quo that comes to us from the previous funding formula and using the growth to address the BUT issues?
No, sir. Originally, by the way, there was one point of view we should fund Portman, fund the 100 or 50 smallest school districts, whatever it costs to fund them, and then build a formula for the rest, because the formula covering an extreme range is very difficult to make work. But we've never, ever pushed that argument very far, but it's part of the struggle you're having right now.
And actually, I think we end up doing something like that. We end up allocating additional dollars to Portland because they have the votes and the political muscle to make that happen.
That's coming out to my suburb, though. Chairman, if you look at the demographics, and we're going to be dealing with redistricting, you look at where the populations are shifting. It's exactly where my school districts, Reynolds, Gresham, Barlow, Centennial, David Douglas, that's where the population's going. The problem we have is we keep accommodating Portland because they theoretically have the political muscle. The problem is they don't have the students, and that school district has not adjusted to meet the actual need, and they refuse to do it, and somehow this body needs to tell them to do that. Now, I would suggest also that we probably should try to facilitate them where we can. But they're sitting on buildings for 80,000 students, and they're trying to deal with that. I suggested to Ben Canada earlier in this session that maybe we ought to try to accommodate buying those buildings from you, or working out some kind of financial arrangement to give you a cash lump sum and buy you out of those buildings, and then try to deal with that some way financially. But at some point, Portland's going to have to deal with it. And I don't care what they say, as long as they continue to cram people into the city's population with higher densities and fewer children living within the communities, that population is going to continue to decline. And my school districts are going to continue to grow.
The other end of that spectrum is we end up getting, there's political clout on the I-5 corridor. There can't be any question about that. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a moral issue that seems to work for the smaller school districts. People just don't want to see community schools die. And so we do end up doing something at both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. It's just as hard to close a community school in Eugene or Coos Bay as it is in Heppner, Iowa. I mean, the people rally around their school in Portland. You could probably close schools in Portland. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But announce which one you're closing, and you have the same kind of disarection if you talk about telling Ione, I'm not proposing this, but there's only 50 high school kids in Ione. It's only 12 miles down the road, and they got a high school bigger. They could bus those kids down there easy. And it wouldn't be a very long bus ride, and it's a relatively decent road. But the people of Ione don't want that. They want to keep their school because that school is the center of their community. And the Alameda, or what, I don't know the names of the schools, you have the same problem inside those big districts. Don't say it ought not be done, but I'm just...
Mr. Chairman,
if we don't get to John's testimony, okay, we won't get there.
I just want to point out, I mean, Ozzie's absolutely right.
Yes.
And I think to give Portland some credit, what they're trying to do where those community issues are at hand, they are trying to set up a different kind of program, like a community center, and they have other forms and mechanisms by which the community's, like, I guess, buying into, purchasing that building so that they've got a community center, okay, so to speak. But I guess...
No, they're not all becoming McMinimins.
Well, some of them. Well, yeah,
former community center. Well, and then, I thought that there was some attempt to make charter schools work in that way to make the educational demands respond in a market way. That sort of hasn't panned out very well. John, you've been able to avoid pretty much all this discussion to this point. You're on. You've got 23 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members,
wisdom and clarity to this committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And I won't take the full 20 minutes, but I do appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts. Certainly the most difficult task that I've had over the last decade is to try to represent the interest of 198 school districts in the debate over the formula and how formula changes can be made to fix the particular problems in a certain school district or group of school districts. We have not taken the approach that my friend Dr. Rose has in terms of bringing together a representative group to focus on formula issues and try to air the laundry in private and come to some consensus. Our legislative committee did meet a couple weeks ago, and I tried to explain to them the issues that were surfacing, and their direction was essentially try to strike a balance, and then we're going to hold you accountable for the outcome. I often think of a phrase that I believe was attributed to Senator Bob Packwood. I've got some of my friends that want to do it this way, I've got some of my friends that want to do it that way, and I just want to be there to help my friends. It would seem to me that if I can use an analogy, that we've got 198 school districts with a variety of illnesses, and the vaccine to cure all those illnesses exists, but we can't get our hands on it. And that the vaccine, of course, is more money in the pot. You raise the level of the lake, then you resolve the small school, the declining enrollment, and a variety of those issues. We don't have the vaccine. Our medicines are limited. So the issue is, how can we, to use the term Senator Minnis used, how can we triage this circumstance to focus the limited medicines we have on the most severe life-threatening ailments? And it would seem to me that when we talk about declining enrollment, at least from what we've heard, is that the declining enrollment circumstance is particularly hard, one, on small school districts, and two, the small high schools in those school districts. And if you think about a community like Marcola or Condon, when enrollment declines, the students don't leave in convenient little packages. It's not like all the third graders leave and you can lay off the third grade teacher and have them enough money left for the rest of the program. Kids leave all over the place. In an elementary school, it's not inconceivable to combine second and third grade, third and fourth grade. In a high school, the issue is, how do you maintain some semblance of a comprehensive program? How do you give kids the various courses they need and have the teachers specialized in those subject areas? How do you give kids the electives that they need to keep them in school? So the real issue seems to be on small high schools. And while the proposal in Senate Bill 509 helped some small schools, not to detract from the severity of the problems in those particular schools that would have been helped, it would seem to me that the focus is on a broader set of small school districts, and in particular those small high schools. So it would, in my view, one of the most serious ailments that our limited medicine ought to be focused on is the broader set of small school districts, and how do you help the small high schools within those school districts. Certainly growth brings with it its own set of circumstances. I think if you would ask school folks, in which condition would you rather find yourself, that of declining enrollment or increasing enrollment, and 2-1, I'm sure they'd say, give us more kids. We'll get $5,200 a kid, and we know that the programs that it will take to serve those students is not going to cost $5,200 across the board, so there are some additional funds. The question is, I think that in terms of enrollment growth, is rapid growth, and is there a point at which the growth is so fast that, granted, you might be able to get a bond measure passed, you might be able to lease portables, there's some facility grant dollars available, but I think the larger issue is, even if you're successful enough in getting the facilities, then to what extent are the dollars available to staff those facilities? One. And two, are the dollars available to provide the infrastructure in those facilities for which we can't bond? The books, the lab supplies, the other things it takes to make a school a school. How you deal with that, I don't know. It would seem to me that the idea on the table for expanding the facilities grant would go a long way to helping those school districts in that growth circumstance. Certainly 2 years ago, when the facility grant dollars were expanded, The percentage was expanded. You could look at the computer simulations and see that those dollars went to those areas where, in fact, they had raised the issue of rapid enrollment growth. So maybe that's a way to deal with that. On the special ed side, I agree with Dr. Rose. The issue is bigger than simply moving from 11 to 13%. Would that serve to reduce some paperwork? It would on the one hand. On the other hand, some have suggested that by having the 11% cap, that creates a check on whether or not those students are in fact, whether there are in fact that number of students eligible for IEPs in the school district, and causes, I think, perhaps a greater examination of exactly the nature of those students and their needs. So I'm not sure that automatically moving to 11 to 13% is necessarily a panacea. I think we have to look at in a broader sense at the whole issue of special education, how we're going to be able to use hopefully some new federal dollars, and begin to look at it, should there be a limit on a school district's liability for those most severe low incidence high cost students? Should there be a pot set aside either in human resources or the Department of Education to help with those very, very expensive and severely disabled students that, frankly, we're sort of babysitting to try to move them along with a great deal of expense for ancillary services. So I think there's a larger issue, and sooner or later we're going to have to focus on that, because I've heard from more than one source that the fastest growing segment of a school district budget is in special education, and I think that's a larger issue. Again, Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me, try to identify the most severe needs and then attempt to strike a balance. A little bit here, a little bit there, enough to begin to focus on the problem and help those school districts with the severest need, while at the same time not trying to upset the apple cart. This is, after all, I mean, if we were going to focus on this whole question from strictly a policy perspective, then I think we all find ourselves marching arm in arm down to Ways and Means to get more money into the pot. But frankly, I think what you face is trying to strike a political balance. And that's our attempt. And hopefully, whatever you do, we will be on board to support, and I can keep my job.
Senator Corcoran, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm sorry I wasn't here, Mr. Chair. I was out doing something else, trying to get some damn money in this building.
The Senator Beyer has a question, but before we go to that, I want to suggest to you that both of these gentlemen have brought a lot of clarity and a lot of ratification to the issues that we've been struggling with. After this morning, I don't think that there's any purpose to the chairman schedule any more hearings on funding bills before this committee, until we get some recommendations from you two gentlemen. The point is that unless there's a broad base of support here to move forward in this committee, there will not be support in the chambers. And if there's no support in the chambers, we truly are beating a dead horse. That is not the chairman's goal. I didn't come to Salem to exercise political opportunities for the airing of philosophies. We either are going to do something here, or we're not going to do something here, and if we're not going to do something here, we can move on to do something unproductive. I believe there are some issues of critical mass, some issues that need to deal with the differences between fixed and variable costs. I believe there's stuff we need to do for the small schools and the small high schools. There is a broader set of questions. We have finite resources. Within those finite resources, I think there is some opportunity. In point of fact, the pot is just a little bit bigger than it was. We ought to take the opportunities that are presented to us to try to create some relief for those communities that are in the worst extremity. And I am basically putting it on you two gentlemen. We're not going to hear more bills until you're ready to come back with recommendations. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this has been helpful. All of the discussion has been helpful for me. Very frustrating, but it's really crystallized for me the situation where we're at in the system. I don't have a solution that's there, and I was struck with John's comments about that, and I think I find myself in the same place between my, or among my friends, different things, but I don't see a situation where we can easily work on either end of the continuum without causing, maybe not irreparable, but harm to the education for the kids in most of the districts. It just seems like my observation right now is that all of the education system is degrading in general, and that's certainly a different position than I had 2 years ago when we walked out of the last session, and I'm bothered by that. I don't have a solution for that. I'm not sure that the economic times let us do that. It could be that we're at the point where this is the best we can do right now.
Well, and that's a possibility. I guess what I'm going to ask my colleagues to do is think very hard about harm in a relative sense. Harm is a relative term. It may be that we're not doing everything that we can do for education for our kids. It may be that we're doing all that we can within the limitations that we have financially. The fact is that this committee is charged with looking at specific bills and will hear the recommendations that come from these two gentlemen representing their broader interests throughout the state of Oregon. And until we get those recommendations, the committee is just not going to spend more time on these issues. And what I'm hoping is that within 10 days or so, we'll have some recommendations that fit within this context. I'm going to ask the co-chairs of Ways and Means and the leadership in this building to get a transcript or a videotape of this hearing, because I believe we've had the first, best, most honest, most direct discussion about what this committee is going to do. There's a lot of pressure on all of us, especially the chair, I don't mind telling you, to tell people what we're going to do and what our agenda is from this committee. I think this last 2 hours of discussion has exactly focused on the right issues. And the question is whether or not we answer the three questions that Mr. Rose so eloquently presented, whether we can do the, what was it, the political?
The science, the pragmatic, and the political issues.
All right, so the science, the pragmatic, and the political issues. I believe the committee's got within its ability and its authority, clearly the ability to get through this issue and come up with something that helps kids. If the committee has the will to do it. We don't have the will to do it. Let's acknowledge that and move on. Any other further comments from the committee? And let's just go through the committee, and we'll start with Senator Castillo.
I think this has been a really helpful discussion. I appreciate the comments from Sabi and John this morning. I sort of feel like that, you know, we have 90 legislators here who all talk about education being a priority, run on that kind of a platform, and we all have the ability to come to a solution where we don't have to do any harm to any school district, and we could step up and help all kids in Oregon. The 90 legislators here in this body, we have the ability to do that. We have the ability to come up with more funding and to help all students be successful in our schools. If we don't do it, it's because, you know, people have decided that isn't a priority and they're not going to do it. And I just hope that before we leave here, before we leave this session, that we do find a good solution, a helpful solution to all of our school districts, because we do have the ability to do that. We can do it if we choose to do it. And I really appreciate that we've had this discussion. It really helps to, you know, bring all the issues forward and help us realize that, you know, our schools, all schools are struggling, all districts are struggling, and that's a shame, because that's our future. And if we don't step up and invest strongly in our schools, our state cannot be strong economically. So I hope that we do find a good solution, a helpful solution to all districts.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chairman, I feel like the surgeon talking to his patients and saying at least he has one leg left.
Senator Starr.
I'm going to be working very hard to see if we spend these dollars in ways that are most productive. I think that certainly has been a helpful discussion, and there are needs that are obvious and need to be met. It's going to be difficult. But, we have to continue to do what's best for all children. And that lower third of our students are not getting the help they need.
Senator Corcoran's excused to attend a press conference. Senator Minnis.
Is it a press conference about this committee?
Senator Minnis, it would please me if the committee's work were making news. We're not.
I guess my closing comments would be this. I don't necessarily share the view that Senator Castillo does with respect to the pot being, you know, not full enough and so on and so forth. I think the truth is, I don't know. And I'd like to ask for some statistical analysis or some numbers to be provided for us in terms of how much money Oregon provides per student compared to other states. And again, I'm not sure how relevant that is, but you know, if I understand correctly, we're not doing too bad by comparison with other states. I mean, one might say all of the states should be doing better, but then when I look at student achievement, performance, and so on and so forth, we're up there from what I understand. So. You know,
you're getting an alibi.
I'm sorry?
You're getting an alibi.
Yeah, exactly. But see, I'd like to at least make those arguments. The premise that I operate under is prove it to me. In other words, I start with a reasonable doubt and say, look, prove it to me. That's why I'll go less, and instead of somebody calling me a dumb SOB, I'd like him to come say, well, Senator Minnis, you don't understand because here's what's going on in the district. You need to understand this. And I've proven, hopefully, through my legislative career, that I'll respond where there's a justification and there's truth. But where there are allegations of, you know, the senator doesn't understand, or he's stupid, or he's just he's a demagogue, or whatever else, I don't respond to that kind of stuff at all. And I've said this, and I've said it to OEA, and said it to others, where you can justify the expenditure and the purpose for which you want to spend the money and articulate that to me, I'm with you. But the problem with education funding is we have not done that. Senator Starr makes extremely good points in terms of how we deliver educational services. The same thing's true with higher education. We're looking at some significant transitions in terms of service delivery in higher education. But the institutions of higher education and others will not face this fact. They refuse to change from their little towers that they've lived in for so long because they don't want the existing institution of education to change. Well, the fact of the matter is technology, world, you know, happenings around the world are changing how we receive educational product. And unless the public education systems respond to that, then we get some big problems. So I guess what I'm trying to say is let's think outside of the box, but at the same time, you know, I want justification from the education community to tell me why they're doing what they're doing. And if they're educating kids and it's supposedly trying to teach them to read, and the methodologies in which they are attempting to teach them to read don't work, then by God, somebody ought to fess up and say, it just friggin' doesn't work. But we at least ought to ask the questions, ask and get answers, as opposed to, you know, we're just a bunch of dumb idiots that never fund education, because I don't think that's necessarily true. Strong comments, but...
Oh, and heartfelt, Senator, I appreciate that. And the chair reserved his comments for the last, and here's what I would suggest to us all. I don't believe, we've argued about the size of the pot. That is not the committee's charge. We've argued about the adequacy of funding. That is not this committee's charge. In point of fact, there is more money in education, and there will be more money spent on education in this session than ever before. That is certain, regardless of whether it's 5.1 or 5.3 or some number, larger or smaller. Even that is not this committee's charge. I don't think that we could look at a 3% or a 6% or even a 10% increase in funding and not have the self same arguments we're having at this moment. So I think what we need to do is, we need to stop posturing, focus on the business of the committee, and make the simple decision whether we're going to make adjustments or not. If we are, we should do them on a rational basis, as our colleague Senator Minnis points out. On a productive basis, as our colleague Senator Starr points out, and maybe in the real sense, as all the committee members have expressed, on a compassionate basis. But let's get on with this. You have the chart to bring back some recommendations. The committee will not hear more education funding bills until that happens. thus endeth the public hearing on Senate Bill 61. We will not be canceling tomorrow's meeting because we've scheduled those. Likely what will happen, colleagues, is a very short tap-in, tap-out on those committee hearings, and I will be asking our leadership to at least review or have their senior staff members and policy analysts review the last 2 hours of this committee, because I think it's been an extraordinary presentation of the reality of our situation. And we are in adjournment until tomorrow at 8:30.